Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Whether you love the action in sports from the NHL, NBA, and the NFL, or if you're really into movies with the Oscars coming up, BetOnline.ag has something for all types of interest. Create a free account on BetOnline.ag to get in on the action and find out how you can win a trip to the NFL's big game on February 3rd. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and the exclusive partner of the Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're gonna take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am currently out on vacation, recharging batteries, but just because I'm recharging the batteries, we still got business to take care of. In the meantime, we'll be playing some of the most requested Steve Austin Show classics that have been locked away in the archives. I got a great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
Thanks, Steve. Time for a classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. This episode is episode number 146 with Paul Heyman. Or Paulie Dangerously, original air date August 28th, 2014. So we're looking at around the time of SummerSlam 2014 just happened, and Paul Heyman's client, Brock Lesnar, trounced John Cena for the WWE Championship at the SummerSlam event. Very much a memorable thing at the time because that match was such a dominant win by Brock. But Paul and Steve sit down. They talk about Paul's entrance into the business as a photographer, as well as his transition into booking and managing. Also working with Eddie Gilbert, discovering Bam Bam Bigelow. They also touch on a little bit about the Ladies and Gentlemen, My Name is Paul Heyman DVD that was released around this time. So good stuff from this classic episode of the Steve Austin Show with Paul Heyman. As far as this day in Steve Austin history, today being January 17th, I did not find anything. Maybe Steve had a day off. Congrats, Steve. You've earned it. Coming up, we've got Paul Heyman on another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show.
All right, check it out. One of my 2019 resolutions is to make this podcast bigger and more badass than it ever was. That being said, what I'm about to offer exceeds anything I was expecting. Thanks to our friends at BetOnline.ag, one of you guys could be going on a once-in-a-lifetime trip to the NFL's biggest game of the year on February 3rd. How do you enter for a chance to attend the big game? Simply get your carcass over to BetOnline.ag, sign up for a BetOnline.ag account, and use the promo code BIGGAME and enter in the contest. There's nothing better than a paid flight, a paid hotel, a VIP tailgate party, and tickets to the big game for you plus a friend, family member, or significant other. The exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet has done it again. BetOnline.ag has the golden tickets, and this is your opportunity to place a bet on yourself. Don't miss out because this promotion ends January 28th. Visit BetOnline.ag for all the details and use promo code BIGGAME to get in on the action. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
You're a photographer. You talked your way into this job. And you started, I guess, taking pictures when you snuck into that job at Studio 54.
Studio 54, I was 19 years old. I snuck in when I was 14 years old. I was obsessed with trying to understand how the show itself worked. And
then when you say show, you're talking about the business of pro wrestling.
Yes, sir.
Because you always wanted to be on the inside.
Yeah, I just couldn't see myself sitting in the stands. It wasn't where I got my enjoyment. I got my enjoyment from understanding how things were done. I've always been more inclined to be a writer, a producer, a director than either a performer or a fan. And I always wanted to know, okay, well, why was this match on first instead of third? Well, why'd they end the show with that match and not put it in the middle? Why is this thing in the middle? And, well, how come there are no two tag team matches in a row? What's the psychology behind this? So why does this baby face win and then a heel wins and then two heels and then the third is a baby? Just all the different combinations that can happen in a show. What's the psychology? What's the mentality behind that? It always fascinated me. So even as a kid, I didn't want to just sit in the stands. I wanted to be behind the scenes. I wanted to learn the industry from the inside. So I found a way to get a hold of Vince McMahon Sr., and I got my way into Madison Square Garden at 14 years old.
Now, and this is all in the Paul Heyman DVD, which is outstanding. It's My Name is Paul Heyman, right?
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Heyman.
I watched this the other day. It was a badass video. But the question I was really going to get to, because and you just expounded upon this, it wasn't necessarily your love for taking pictures that got you on the inside of the wrestling business. You used that as a tool to get in the system.
Yeah, I exploited the opportunity of having a really nice camera and a photo lab in my basement to get me inside so I could start the process of learning the actual industry.
Okay, that being said, what was your rig when you first started out? And if you were left to your own devices today, and you've got everybody running cameras for you. I know Ari's down there, and he's your photographer here, and you work with them all over the place. What was your startup system back in the day? And if you were to grab a camera today and just start taking digital pictures, an SLR maybe, what would you use?
The camera that everybody on my staff likes to brag about is the Canon 7D.
Right.
Because it's not only still pictures, but it can also be used for video.
And so many people are using that for video these days.
Yes. And the sound on it is pretty damn good. The quality. I like, from what I can tell, and I'm only speaking from the experience of reviewing the work that's submitted to me, I think the 7D is far better than the 5D. A significant upgrade is the 7D. But I mean, I haven't picked up, I use my iPhone for pictures. You know,
I do too. I got a little T2i that I take pictures of my deer with. But what was your go-to rig when you first got into business? Hell, back when you were a kid.
I had a Minolta, and I had, as a bar mitzvah present, of course, what other Jewish kid doesn't exploit all of his bar mitzvah presents? Someone gave me a really nice Nikon camera. But I didn't like shooting with the Nikon because it was too stiff of a camera for me. The Minolta was far better. So what I did was I'd have both cameras around my neck, and I was a big believer in black and white photography. It's just far more dramatic of lighting. And back then there wasn't a lot of colors in the wrestling magazines. It was, you know, a color cover, and then sometimes Pro Wrestling Illustrated, which came out in 79, I believe, they had a color centerfold. But besides that, everything else was black and white. So I used to put my color pictures, which was a 64 chromochrome or ektachrome. I don't really remember which one, but it was 64. I remember the 64. And that was in my Nikon, but my 400 ASA film was in the Minolta. So I'd have the Nikon, so they go, oh, there, this kid knows what he's doing. He has a Nikon. He must be doing some good photography. But I'd always use the Minolta.
Hey, there's the footage. It might be a still shot of you in your DVD. And looks to be you're a teenager, probably 16, 17, 18 years old, at the Garden. Bill Apter has got a soundbite from him. He was wonderful on the DVD. Says you were the biggest pain in the ass at ringside of anybody he's ever dealt with. But anyway, there was this look with you there, and you just kind of had this look. I mean, you were in your element. You looked excited. What was the mindset back then? Here you are, a young cat, and then you got George Napolitano, Bill Apter, the who's who of all the old wrestling magazines that we all grew up and still love today. And, of course, back in the old days, you know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated was the Bible. You know, guys would go down the territory. I mean, you would see guys that you'd never heard of before, like, but you would go through that top 10 list, and it actually meant something. But back to the Garden, you at a young age, how competitive was that environment? Were you like a kid in a candy store because this was your way in, and you're there with some hard, heavy-duty cats fighting it out for the good pitchers?
Yes to all answers. I think I still am the biggest pain in the ass ringside that there ever has been in the industry. It was very competitive in the fact that Bill Apter and George Napolitano were the old guard. And here I came in as a kid, and they knew I was a kid, clearly. But nobody else really knew, is he 15? Is he 18? Is he going to high school? Is he going to college? You really couldn't tell,
yeah.
You know, because I had some height on me. And my face was a little more mature than most 13, 14, 15-year-olds. So, you know, I mean, I was clearly a kid, but you didn't know how much of a kid I was. But here I was clearly giving pictures every month to Vince McMahon Sr. And nobody knew whether I was getting paid for them or not. And I was getting $50 a garden show for Vince McMahon to cover my trans, you know. But they could tell that I was developing a rapport. Hey, who is this kid walking up to Vince Sr.? These guys didn't really have that type of carte blanche. They would see him. They would wave. They'd keep their head down. They would shake his hand if the opening was there to do so. But here I was every month coming in with a stack of pictures, walking up to Vince Sr. And, it, you know, the gumption, the balls, the chutzpah to actually do that really pissed off the old guard of the magazine set. I found it very competitive, although both Bill Apter and George Napolitano ended up buying a lot of my pictures and ended up writing stories for George Napolitano's magazine, because Bill Apter's magazine kind of had their own writing staff, but they would buy a bunch of pictures from me too, especially when I'd go on to some shows that they themselves weren't covering. So it was hyper competitive, but at the same time, you know, I was a kid that was getting shots that they weren't getting, even if I had to elbow Bill Apter out of the way for me to get the shot that I didn't want him to get.
So, but there was the combative element, because you said on more than one occasion he missed a hell of a cover shot because he was getting whacked across the head, or it's surely some were intentional and some were unintentional.
Well, that's when I used the Nikon, was because I could see this was a cover shot and I wanted to use the color film. And hey, if Bill Apter happens to be getting the same picture, then he has no need for my pictures. And I don't think the photographers were used to a little bit of ruthlessness being brought into the equation back then.
So you used a camera to get in, but then once you got in, what was your first endeavor in the business of pro wrestling? Was it down? Was that Florida? Was it Atlanta when you snuck your way? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, no.
No, I just, when you snuck your way into that production meeting that Dusty was having, which you talk about on the DVD, but after being a photographer, get on the inside because you want the inner workings, what was that first stop?
The first thing I did was actually exactly 29 years ago this week. I promoted and produced Wrestle Party 85 at Studio 54.
Man of the Year.
Man of the Year, Ric Flair.
Yeah. The Man of the Year was going to be
Hulk Hogan.
But because Hogan was across the country and NWA was in
Philadelphia, right.
Was it that easy of a switch to go from, I mean, Paul E., this is Man of the Year. All of a sudden.
Well, it's not Time Magazine Man of the Year.
I know, but I mean, your first option was Hulk Hogan. He was so immediately thinking on your feet, you had to change the game plan to do something that would facilitate your party.
Yeah, it had to be somebody. I mean, it had to be somebody.
You're hustling.
Absolutely. I mean, if it wasn't Ric Flair, it would have been Dusty Rhodes. And if it wasn't Dusty Rhodes, it would have been Magnum T.A. And if it wasn't Magnum T.A., it would have been the Rock and Roll Express. And if it wasn't the Rock and Roll Express, I would have ended up giving it to Vince himself. It didn't matter. This had to be somebody around whom I could build that Friday night promotion, because I was also, at the same time, looking to advocate, looking to hustle here. I presented Bam Bam Bigelow's pro wrestling debut.
Now, what was it about the Bam Bam Bigelow that tied you guys together? Were y'all great friends from the young days?
I was at the Monster Factory shooting pictures for Larry Sharp and Buddy Rogers. Buddy Rogers was still the owner or the co-owner or in charge of the Monster Factory on this particular day in 1984, when a bunch of really tough street guys from Asbury Park, New Jersey, rolled into town with Scott Charles Bigelow, who had a few tattoos on his head at the time and had just gotten out of a jail stint for kidnapping, because he didn't check in with the police. He was a bounty hunter. And he didn't.
Bam Bam was?
Bam Bam Bigelow was a legitimate bounty hunter, but he didn't do his job the right way. And he's supposed to check in with the police department when you were about to execute, not a prisoner,
right,
when you're supposed to execute a warrant for arrest and bring somebody back to the bail bondsman. He didn't check in with the police. So he got charged with kidnapping. He ended up spending some time in jail. And when he got out of jail, these guys from Asbury Park brought him down to be trained by Buddy Rogers. However, on this particular day, Buddy Rogers was getting out of the Monster Factory business and selling the rest of the school, the percentage of the school, to Larry Sharp. Buddy Rogers got back into the business in the 1980s because his stepson, David, was a good athlete, good-looking kid, and Buddy was going to break him into the business. And so he opened up a wrestling school with Larry Sharp because Buddy used to do a lot of business with Larry Sharp's father, Augie Weil. Augie Weil used to rent a lot of rings up and down the East Coast, which is a business that Larry Sharp took over. So that's how Buddy knew Larry. But the business wasn't for David, and David opted to pursue other avenues of employment. And so once David didn't want to be in the business anymore, Buddy, who had more than enough money to retire many times over, said, well, then I'm out too. So, Pally, I'm out too, Pally. So, worst Buddy Rogers imitation ever, but a shout out to Buddy Rogers. So, Bigelow comes into the school on a day that I'm taking photographs, and Buddy Rogers just sees this monster walk in the door, and Bigelow was clearly 400 pounds at the time.
Right.
And Buddy says, well, let's see if you can just do a flat back bump. Here, put your hands on the top rope, and then I want you to throw your feet out, your belly towards the ceiling, and tuck your chin. And Bigelow does it, and he does a beautiful flat back bump the first time. So then Buddy says, well, let me see you do a forward roll. And Bigelow was a high school wrestler, so he could do forward rolls. So it was not much for him. So as a joke, Buddy just says, time to weed this kid out right here. And there was a wrestler at the school named Sailor Eddie Shore. You know, typical 1980s name. And Sailor Eddie Shore lies down on the mat, and Buddy has one of the other kids who was a high flyer, and I think it was someone who actually used the name Jim Lundos, named after the wrestler from 100 years ago. And Lundos does a top rope splash onto Sailor Eddie Shore. And Bigelow says, hey, man, could I just see that one more time? And Lundos goes up to the top rope, and he does the splash, and Bigelow says, I could do that. Now, you know, first day in a wrestling school, someone lying down underneath a 400-pound man coming to the top rope.
Green as grass. Scary.
Sailor Eddie Shore had the balls of a lion. And, lions have balls? Of a gorilla, of a big, impactful gorilla. So Bigelow goes to the top rope, and it's the most magnificent top rope splash you've ever seen. He was a prodigy. He's like these 5-year-olds that listen to Mozart one time, sit down and play Mozart on the piano. So Larry Sharp agreed to train him because Buddy Rogers was leaving the school. And Larry Sharp agreed to train him for a percentage of his earnings, which they ended up in a lawsuit over anyway.
Right.
But that Bigelow would sleep in the school, which was an airplane hangar, and clean it up every day and be the property manager, for lack of a better definition, of the Monster Factory. So and he'd work on the ring crew as well. $400 a day, and that would come off of what he had to pay Larry Sharp. So I was there, and I took Bam Bam Bigelow's very first ever pictures in the wrestling business. I saw him on the day that he came out to try to break into the business, and obviously I said, well, this guy is a star, and especially back in the 1980s, a monster that could move like that, who, you know, missing teeth and a tattooed head. I thought Scott was a can't miss. So I started doing pictures of him in the magazines before he ever debuted. And the whole concept was every manager in wrestling was talking to Bam Bam Bigelow to sign the hottest free agent that has yet to debut. And which is the funniest thing, that when he came to WWE, they did, was it the Hunt for Bam Bam or the Quest for Bam Bam, whatever they called it. It was all the managers trying to sign Bam Bam Bigelow, right. And he ended up with Humperdinck, which is just so funny because it was my idea. So anyway,
your ties to him when you're trying to promote this gig at Studio 54,
right? And I figured, you know, hey, let's give Bam Bam his debut the right way. So we had Otis Day and the Knights,
but the Man of the Year, although it was Flair, was all about Bam Bam Bigelow.
Yes, it was a way to draw people in to see the professional wrestling debut of Bam Bam Bigelow. It really didn't matter if the Man of the Year was Hulk Hogan or Roddy Piper or Ric Flair or Dusty Rhodes or whomever. What mattered was I was getting people to come to Studio 54 to see Bam Bam Bigelow. And if I had just gone to the media, to Page Six, to of the New York Post to the USA Today to the local news stations in New York. And I said, hey, Bam Bam Bigelow is going to debut at Studio 54. Well, who gives a shit? No one's going to give a shit about that. But if I say, hey, Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair or Dusty Rhodes getting the Man of the Year award at Studio 54 and these two worlds are going to collide together, oh, wow, we'd be very interested in covering that. And by the way, would you mind mentioning Bam Bam Bigelow is going to make his pro wrestling debut? No, of course, we'll throw that into
the
story.
But was the debut that night at Studio 54?
Yes.
Y'all set up a ring?
Yes.
How many matches?
One match, four opponents, and Bam Bam beat all four. And, of course,
now, how did the crowd respond to this? Because this is Studio 54, the biggest disco damn near in the world. In New York City, world-famous Studio 54. Were they down with what was going on? Did they get it?
Yeah, they loved the spectacle because it was truly a Friday night spectacle in the world's most famous nightclub. So
everybody's so coked out of their mind, they didn't know where to shit, wine, and watch. Anyway, tell me about the scenes back in Bali, about the nitty-gritty of Studio 54, because, man, that was back in the heyday, and I've only read about it. But basically, in that day and age, it was anything and everything. Plain vision, no kayfabe, just drugs out the ass. Is that a shoot?
It was Caligula. Now, here's the funny thing. A lot of people that worked at Studio 54 will tell you that I was there way past the heyday. That okay. The heyday was the Steve Rubell, Ian Schrager era of 1977, and then they all got busted in 1978, and they all went to jail for tax evasion and drug use and drug distribution and everything else. And they had a number of different owners that were in and out. 85 was, I'm very lucky. I got in at the right time in the right place. I came into Studio 54 in March 1985, and it was experiencing a real resurgence under an owner by the name of Mark Fleischman. And they had hired back in 84 a general manager, though he was called the director, he was a general manager of the club, a guy named Worsham Rudd, who was just a fabulous old school nightclub guy in New York City. And he ran many different clubs. He ran the Copacabana and a number of different nightclubs that I slipped my mind. But he, dating back to the 60s and the 70s, he ran the top nightclubs in New York City. And he was the architect of a real resurgence for Studio 54. When I was there, it was Caligula. It was just balls to the wall, absolute decadence and debauchery everywhere you looked. Here's an example. When I went to work at Studio 54, the first question that I was asked was, you want to be on payroll? You want to just take it in cash off the books? Or would you be interested in being paid in cocaine? They paid people in cocaine because apparently one of the people that was in charge of payroll had a great source of cocaine. Now, in my entire life, despite being around some very wild times in this business and nightclub business, I have never in my life done a line of cocaine, ever.
Right.
I've never put it on my teeth. I've never snorted it off of a stripper's tuchus. I've never done a line of cocaine. And there are several reasons why. Number one, you remember me when I was younger and much thinner. My level of intensity was enough to be a walking heart attack as it was. I could never imagine putting an upper into my body. I was sure my heart would blow up. Number two, there was a very famous basketball player named Len Bias.
Yeah.
And this is when I was a kid. And Len Bias, what was, you know, the top draft pick or one of the top draft picks, went out with all his buddies on the night he was signed by the NBA, snorts a line of cocaine, and drops dead. And I just always imagined any time I was even around it or in a room where the cocaine was flowing freely, I always imagined doing one line, dropping dead, and looking up from my grave and seeing my father standing over my grave crying and saying, of all the things to throw your life away for, this is what you chose. And it's just the image of my dad crying over my grave because I threw everything away for cocaine. That deterred me from ever, to this day, my father's not even around, not even here anymore. And to this day, I would never dare ingest, you know, even a line, because I'm not, I always had that image of my father crying over my grave, saying, why, of all the things to throw your life away for, you chose this.
Now, I remember back in the day, I did delve into a line here and there. I can say that now. That was many, many years ago. But I stopped that shit because I didn't want to be the guy that got remembered for being the guy. This was, I'm cutting a Paul Heyman promo here. Hey, after having such a spectacular run, was the guy landing that casket because he didn't know when to say when, or it was just one thing would lead to another. So I left that shit alone way back in the day. But so that led you into when you hustled that job at Studio 54. And if you guys watch, My Name is Paul Heyman, the DVD. It's an outstanding DVD, which I highly suggest. If you have any love or care about the business of pro wrestling, any whatsoever, you will enjoy this DVD. It's so full of information, passion, knowledge. But you got into the business, and you went over to Studio 54 as a photographer because you had some photography skills. And then because the promoter lost his job, you started promoting. That's your first promoting job. You started, helped start the career of Bam Bam Bigelow. But that was always your means to an end, was to get to the wrestling business. Your first gig from there, because that was your first promotion,
was play-by-play announcing. And again, 1985, WrestleMania hit. Vince McMahon and WWE were just expanding all over the place. And it was also the expansion of cable television at the very same time. So everyone had local television because Cox Cable New England or Time Warner Cable New Jersey or whatever the
right.
the cable companies were, everyone had local television clearances on the local cable systems. And everyone was doing independent wrestling because there was so much talent out there and so much talent in between Crockett and Vern, or Vern and WWE, or WWE and Crockett, or Georgia or Texas. There was so much talent out there that you could always run an independent show with some names that had recognition in the area. And then Sergeant Slaughter left WWE, and he was pricing himself very high, but he was still booking himself left and right on all these Northeast independents. Well, all these Northeast independents had television because production was cheap and you could get a local cable clearance. Today, we call it local access, but back then, it was a big deal. You know, you're watching Victoria, Texas, Channel 33. And that was a big deal because right. It was the local television station and the expansion of cable television. So all these Northeast independents had television shows. And because I was getting all these Northeast independents into the wrestling magazines and I was doing their programs at the venues, and the inserts to the programs as well, and then selling magazines at the concession stand, at the merchandise stand, and doing a split with the promoter. It only made sense for them to use me on television as well because I was there and I could talk and I had a passion for the business. And I was always feeding, hey, why don't you do this with this guy and this with that guy? And, you know,
you're spitting out angles already?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, give me the company that you're laying down this commentary for.
Let's see. There was...
There
was a million of them. It was just all at once. It was DC Drake and a manager named Damian Kane were working a lot of the Northeast independents, and DC Drake was a booker for a bunch of them. For example, there was the National Wrestling Federation, which was the NWF, which was run by a guy named Rob Russin and Mike Dano. And I wish I could remember their third partner, and I apologize to you, sir, if you're listening, for not remembering your name, because they gave me a great break, which I've just showed my lack of appreciation for. But they had television, but they had...
What are you calling matches? What are you actually doing?
Oh, yeah, I was trying to be, you know, Gordon Solie, Jim Ross, Vince McMahon. And yeah, I was just doing play-by-play, you know, and I was helping put together the
one
TV
guy,
shows.
Joey Styles fashion, or did you
usually
have a partner?
No, usually they'd have different partners in and out. For example, Jules Strongbow. Jules Strongbow worked for Appa and Sika had a promotion called the Trans World Wrestling Federation. Then there was a guy from New Haven called A.W. Constantini. He had the Can-Am Wrestling Federation. Everything was a wrestling
now,
federation.
What was the first style of your commentary? Because when you were down in NWA, and you were the first time I saw you or listened to you, and you were managing, and they hooked you up with Jim Ross, and as he says on the DVD, bombastic would be one of the ways he described you. What was your early on style? Because, and this was obviously pre-manager, so were you more commentary flavored than the personality that you became once you turned into a manager?
I tried to call the action as a straight play-by-play. I wasn't Paulie Dangerously yet.
Okay.
So I was just Paul Heyman, and I was just trying to be a play-by-play guy, but I was so acerbic. I was such an asshole at that age. Oh, God, was an asshole. I couldn't hide it. And so
Now, why were you an asshole? Because it's your whole life's dream, and you're still a youngster to get in the business. Here you are, but you're an asshole. So, I mean, were you condescending in your commentary? What do you mean by that?
No, I always favored the heels. Yeah. I could always justify things, you know.
Yeah, okay.
I'd end up trying to put heat on the heels for kicking the crap at the baby faces. And
but then again, ladies and gentlemen, there is one man standing tall tonight, and you may not like him, but he's standing over your hero.
And I'm sitting there saying, well, that didn't do him any good. I just put all the heat on myself. But again, you know, I learned about the psychology of speaking from Freddie Blassie and Lou Albano and Ernie Roth, the Grand Wizard. So I was raised by heels.
Right.
You know, so it's like the scorpion and the frog. You know, why'd you sting me? It's me nature, you know? So I'm doing play-by-play, and of course the object is to put sympathy and hope on the baby faces and to put heat and venom and disdain and disgust and contempt on the heels. I end up just advocating for the heels. I was such a horrible play-by-play man because I ended up morphing into being the color guy because that's just the viewpoint that I always had.
Make sure to stick around after this podcast to get the latest headlines from the AP News Minute.
The fight for the football postseason is underway, and the sports betting expert RJ Bell is wired into the big game.
I feel good about it, and thank you so much for all the support. It really means a lot.
Tune in to hear the best analysis and play-by-plays before RJ heads to Atlanta for the final showdown.
Jibber-jabber all you want, as long as you're one of the best guys out there. Whoop, deal with it. And then when you're not, bye-bye.
Download RJ Bell's Dream Preview every week on Podcast One Sportsnet or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Steve Austin. Unleashed.
Well, how did you end up down in Continental where you kind of teamed up with Eddie Gilbert?
Well,
dude, you're a New Yorker. All of a sudden, now you're down south. Because where was Continental based out of at that time?
Montgomery, Alabama.
Right. Dude, yeah. I mean, you're kind of out of place over there. How'd that happen?
I knew Eddie from when I was a photographer, and he was in WWE as a kid. You know, just enhancement talent, really. But I knew him and I met him.
I didn't
him.
Know that he'd been up over doing jobs.
He was Bob Backlund's protege in many ways. Bob Backlund kind of looked after him because Bob Backlund knew Tommy Gilbert from St. Louis in Kansas City. So, Eddie had come to New York.
And Eddie's father would be Tommy Gilbert.
Tommy Gilbert, yes, right. Sir. Back in those days, Vince McMahon Sr. used a lot of the very young talent that ended up becoming big stars. Kurt Hennig's first run in WWE was not as Mr. Perfect. He came in as Kurt Hennig, and he was an enhancement talent, except for his Madison Square Garden debut where they had his father, Larry the Axe Hennig, come halfway down the aisle just to escort him out to the ring. But besides that, he was always just, you know, Kurt Hennig, right. You know, and he would team with guys like Steve Travis, and once in a while, you know, there'd be a six-man, and he'd get to team with Tony Gurria and so, you know, or Dominic DiNucci, but he was enhancement talent. And Eddie Gilbert was brought up as enhancement talent, you know, just a good young white meat baby face. So I knew Eddie, and I had worked in Florida, then Memphis, then I worked for Vern, and I left Vern. And when I left Vern, I ended up going to Georgia because Jerry Blackwell opened up a promotion with Joe Pedicino and Tommy Rich. Based out of Marietta, Georgia, and which was a big culture shock for me, both from the perspective of living in the South, but also because I'd just come off 6 months of national TV with Vern, and I walked away from it. And now I'm on this tiny little promotion in the South, but I lucked into becoming the booker, Sam DeCero, who had just opened up Windy City Wrestling in Chicago. So I'm booking Chicago, and we were
now. Why would he have the wherewithal to hire you for as a booker? Because you don't have a history of booking.
I had just come off Vern's TV,
okay,
and I was hot in that area of the country. Vern still had strong syndication as well as ESPN in Chicago. So Sam DeCero was looking to launch his promotion, and he wanted Paulie Dangerously to come in. And I said, I'll do it, but I want to be the booker. I want to book. And Sam said, well, what would you do? And I had a list of his talent, and I wrote out the first four TV shows, and I said, well, here's what I would do. And he liked it, and he gave me my first booking job. So I was booking for Windy City Wrestling, and I was working in Marietta and, you know, the small towns in and around Atlanta. And Eddie Gilbert came in because he was old friends with Tommy Rich. So Eddie came in to do a shot, and he brought his brother Doug and Missy with him. And he pulls me aside. He says, hey, I'm taking over Alabama. The Fullers have sold the promotion again to a guy named David Woods. And David Woods was the owner of WCOV-TV, Birmingham, Alabama. And no, Montgomery. I'm sorry. David, he bought it out of Montgomery, Alabama. So David Woods is now the owner of Continental, and Eddie Gilbert is getting the book. And Eddie wants me to come in and be his assistant booker, and offered to be my assistant booker in Windy City. So we'd play role reversal, which was a very interesting concept. So it's really a booking team, really two guys booking, but one takes the lead in Alabama, which was our regular gig because we were working five, six nights a week. And one would take the lead in Chicago, where we were doing TV, but also only working three shots a month sometimes. So we kind of meshed together. And
so then what was your philosophy versus Eddie Gilbert's philosophy in regards to, hey, man, we got to get all the heels hot? How heat-based was it?
Eddie was a heel booker. Eddie was a really smart heel booker. The difference in philosophy is what really balanced us out together really well. It's funny because I felt the same chemistry with CM Punk many years later that Eddie and I had together. But again, that was another role reversal because clearly Eddie was a mentor and I was Eddie's protege. The difference in our philosophies was Eddie always was influenced by and wanted to recreate angles that he saw in Memphis many, many years earlier.
Right.
So this is what Jerry Lawler did in 77 with Jackie Fargo, or this is what Bill Dundee did with Buddy Landell, or this is what Sputnik Monroe did with my dad. And he'd want to put a different spin or twist on it, but essentially he just wanted to do the things that he had seen growing up. I always felt tasked to do something new and different and never before done. First time ever. A different approach. A new twist on things. So that was the only conflict that we really had, and that Eddie wanted to rehash but update, and I wanted to start from a blank piece of paper and make things up from the get-go.
Well, what was y'all's relationship like? Because, I mean, it's pretty much on record with you and Vince Buttonheads back in the day when you weren't as politically inclined as you currently are. And you're very outspoken. You're very passionate about what you believe in and very vocal in getting that out. But back in, you're his protege. So how did that relationship work?
It was interesting because we argued our asses off, but it was so productive and it was so learning for both of us.
Okay.
It was almost
like one of those think tanks that you currently do through the Heyman Hustle.
Looking for Larry agency.
Right.
Yeah. We do think tanks, you know, with all these young kids and we talk to them and we'll debate things out. You know what it's like? It's like you and I used to get in a room and I always go back to your matches with Ricky Steamboat. Because so many light bulbs for you went on when you were working with Ricky Steamboat. I used to watch it every night and just, I'd come back, you know, Rude would be behind the curtain, you know, and Rude would always watch your matches because Rick saw just where you were headed, you know, and Rude would say, did you see how much he picked up from Steamboat tonight? I was like, hey, pretty soon Steamboat's going to be learning from Austin, and Rude, you know, take a big hit of that cigarette that he'd be smoking and say, yep. Not a bad way to make a living. Maybe it's just me, but this Austin is going to be a big-time star. So when you and Steamboat and I would get in a room, he'd have some ideas. You'd say, wait a minute. What about we did this? And I remember the one that I go back to, is you did this one, and this was yours, and he didn't want to do it. But you pressed him, and you pressed him, and you pressed him until he saw the light. And because you were becoming a ring general and he was really getting that out of you. And it was the night that we did the show in the Omni. And at first you offer to shake his hand and he looks at the audience and, you know, they're going, no, 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 don't shake his hand. He's a heel. He's a villain. He's a jerk. We don't like him. And you offer to shake his hand and he shoves your hand away and you're like, okay, here we go. You know, and you do the match and it begins and he gives you a couple of arm drags and now he offers you his hand and you're mad and you slap it away. So now he comes in, chop, 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 and boom, when you cut him off for the heat, it was probably, you know, I distracted the ref and you did a nut shot or something like that.
Right.
You know, old school, you know, yeah, heel stuff. And he's down on the canvas selling and you reach down while he's selling and you shake his hand and you go, okay, now you son of a bitch, now shake your hand, now we're friends, it's nice to shake your hand now. And the audience went nuts. They were booing the living crap out of you. And I just remember how long it took you to sell that to Steamboat. Long story even longer, that was not an argument where he felt disrespected that you would debate it. It was a productive argument with two very passionate people, and you sold him on what you wanted to do. That's how Eddie and I were. We would argue all the time, but it was learning, and I'd listen to what he's saying. I'd say, okay, well, that works. But what if we do it this way? Well, I like that, but, you know, I don't like number three in there. What if you change that to a pile driver or a headlock or a walk out of the ring and you walk back or whatever the spot may be? So we would argue productively, and it was fascinating, and it was fun, and it was never, well, you know what? Well, screw you, asshole. I want to do it this way. It was never like that. It was fun. It was engaging. It was exhilarating because I was learning from his concept. He was learning from mine, and we were putting our ideas together, and then to watch it play out, that's what the exhilaration, that's what the orgasmic experience of being a booker was all about.
Was Eddie Gilbert as bright as everybody made him out to be? Because I think I met Eddie a time or two and saw a lot of his work, but I just always heard of the brilliance of Eddie Gilbert. But again, didn't get a chance to hang around him. Was he that smart of a guy? And where what was his learning tree? Where did he come from? Was that straight up from working Tennessee with Lawler and Jarrett?
Yes. Eddie Gilbert was this. I think Eddie was third generation. I think Eddie's either grandmother or grandfather was in the business. And obviously his father was a longtime veteran in the Tennessee area and then became a respected referee for Bill Watts. So Eddie grew up in the business. Eddie grew up as a little boy going to see Jackie Fargo and Jerry Lawler. And obviously he was the world's biggest Jerry Lawler fan, and to the point of obsession at times, where I thought it was unhealthy for Eddie, and that he truly wanted to be Jerry Lawler.
Right.
Eddie's first wife, Eddie married his first wife, not Missy, it was the wife before Missy. Eddie married his first wife because she looked like Jerry Lawler's wife. And that was just Eddie's obsession with Jerry Lawler. Was Eddie brilliant? Absolutely. Absolutely a brilliant mind, driven by a second to none passion for the business, a great Finnish man, an understanding of heat on the heels and when to blow it off. Eddie's timing in a storyline and putting storylines together and when they would arc and when they would peak and how they could be used to draw money was brilliant. The best in his day. I don't think Eddie was original, which I think over time would bite him in the ass. Although one of the greatest angles of the 1980s, and I'll say this to this day, one of the most heated angles I've ever seen was when, and Eddie was the booker, was when in the UWF, the Russians put the flag over Bill Watts. And that was so well done, and that Eddie came out on TV. I'd like to apologize. I want to talk to Bill Watts. Bill Watts won't come out to talk to you. Okay. Comes out a second time. Okay. I want to talk to Bill Watts. I need to talk to Bill Watts. Bill Watts needs to talk to me. And I'm serious about this. And Bill Watts won't talk to you. And the third time he comes out, I'm not leaving until he comes out to talk to me. So here comes Bill Watts. Bill Watts comes down to the ring. And Eddie says, this is a Russian flag. And I have disgraced myself and my family and my country by associating with it. And, sir, you're a great man, and I'm not going to change my ways, but I'm not going to associate with the Russians anymore. You've made me see the light. And as he's talking, the Blade Runners, Sting and Jim Hellwig, who ultimately became the Ultimate Warrior, come down the aisle. And Bill Watts sees them, and he starts to smell the trap, and then he says, it's okay, guys. I'm just telling Mr. Watts, I'm still going to manage you. I'm still going to manage the Blade Runners, Mr. Watts. And if that puts us at cross purposes, that's fine. But I'm done with the Russians, and you can do with that flag what you want. And Watts goes, let's burn it. Yeah, let's burn it. The place is going crazy. And, of course, the Russians come in from the side, and they blindside the cowboy, and they bust him over with the shovel, and they put the flag on the cowboy. And Jim Ross in... pre-WrestleMania 17, the greatest call of Jim Ross's life. And if you could pull this up on YouTube, I implore you, if you are a wrestling fan, this is as good as a call can ever be. And if you're not a wrestling fan, you'll appreciate it anyway. You'll end up becoming a wrestling fan for this. And Jim Ross is screaming, they put the flag on the cowboy! They put that bear in the cowboy under the Russian flag! And here come the baby faces. Here comes Dr. Death and Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Ted DiBiase. But the Blade Runners are blocking the aisle. Yeah. And so now that flag stays on the cowboy. And this is not, you know, one of the things we do today... In the past 10 years that I don't like is that the beatdowns go on forever, that the heels will beat on a baby face in heat for 5 minutes. And it just doesn't make sense to me. There needs to be a sense of urgency when you're getting this type of heat. So every second that the baby faces are fighting in the aisle, trying to get past the Blade Runners to take the flag off the cowboy. Not to see if he's okay. Yeah. Not to see if he's alive, but by God, if he's dead, get that damn Russian flag off of American hero, Cowboy Bill Watts. And the urgency in Jim, he's under the flag! The cowboy has been buried under the flag! And the baby faces finally get into the ring and the heels get out and they pull the flag off the cowboy, and his son, Joel Watts, had come out of the production truck, and they're holding Bill Watts up like a wounded soldier, and the blood is pouring down his face. That was as heated and as emotional and as money-drawing an angle as I ever saw in the 1980s. And we're talking the Hulkamania era. That was Eddie Gilbert, and that was Eddie at his absolute best. My only knock on Eddie, and it's not a knock, we're all influenced somehow. I've always thought that a lot of people are only, very creative people, are only limited by the boundaries of their own imagination. And I think Eddie, overcompensating for a great deal of insecurity, because he was an insecure person, I think Eddie relied on the boundaries of his own imagination that were self-imposed by looking for these Jerry Lawler and Jackie Fargo and Bill Dundee and Jerry Jarrett angles, instead of allowing his own creativity to take over and do things that had never been done before, never thought of before, that would have made it to this day described as an Eddie Gilbert angle. Because really, what is an Eddie Gilbert angle? There's no brand of what Eddie brought to the table. And that's a shame, because I learned so much from him and he offered so much to the business. He just never offered his own branding of it.
Well, that's interesting. You spent time in the WWF, and like you said, Grand Wizard, Captain Lou Albano, Freddie Blassie were some of your mentors. They took you under their wing. For some reason, they liked you. But so there you were in New York. And then you snuck into a production meeting down there in NWA. Dusty had the book. And, you know, you're in the back of the room, and he says, hey, kid, you know, what are you doing here? You can't be here. Hey, I'm Paul Heyman. And,
right.
You know, there's a story on a DVD. I don't want to give the whole story up, so you can go buy the DVD. It's awesome. But what was the difference in booking philosophies back in that time from New York versus NWA?
New York is a babyface territory.
Explain that, because I've always known that. You've always known that. What's the difference between a babyface territory and what the NWA was doing?
The WWWF, WWF, WWE is built on the premise that the hero is the end-all, be-all, that the center of the universe is the top star, and the top star is my guy. My guy, Bruno Sammartino. My guy, Bob Backlund. My guy, Hulk Hogan. My guy, Stone Cold Steve Austin. My guy, John Cena. That the face of the company, that the embodiment of the company, that the premise of the company, the theory of the company, the marketing, the promotion of the company is all based around the hero, the man himself, the person that will take WWF, WWWF, WWE, not only into the future, but will be the flag waver for the company. And he is the end all be all. He's the centerpiece. He's the star. And everything else that goes around WWE is an offshoot of that product. The brand is branded on the top star. The NWA was a heel-based territory. The story wasn't the revenge of the babyface as fait accompli. See, here's just to add to that. When someone would jump, when Spiros Arion would crack Bruno Sammartino with a chair, when Earthquake would break Hulk Hogan's ribs, when The Rock would double-cross Stone Cold Steve Austin, it would build to a match, Bruno's revenge, Hulk's revenge. Stone Cold will open up a can of whoop-ass on The Rock. You knew the heels were going to get their comeuppance. You knew the babyface was going to get his revenge, and you'd have to pay to see that happen. In the NWA, the babyfaces were fighting from underneath. The heels were on top, and it was the chase for the title, the chase for revenge. WWE was all about the destination. Pay me now, see Austin exact revenge. NWA was about the journey of the babyface. Pay me now, and you'll see my struggles in getting to the top. John Wayne has a bullet in his gut, but damn it, he's going to take the hill. Come see John Wayne's journey as he struggles up that hill, and those no good foreign bastards keep on raining down all hell and havoc on him. WWE, our guy's taking the hill. He's going to plant the WWE flag on top, and we're all going to wear his T-shirts and celebrate alongside with him.
Okay, with that being said, the way WWE and the NWA's philosophy was, what would you then say was the ECW philosophy?
Yeah, the ECW philosophy was to make stars.
To make stars, and you took us over. Eastern Championship Wrestling was already born. Everybody thinks you started ECW. Eastern Championship Wrestling was up and running. Todd Gordon was the owner.
Yes.
Brought you in the book.
Yes.
You ended up taking over based on your booking. So anyway, I cut you off, but I wanted to just say that.
My philosophy in ECW was just to make stars. It didn't matter to me if they were heels or baby faces. It mattered to me that they got across to the public, and the public was willing to pay to see them or buy the videotapes or watch them on television. If you wanted to cheer somebody, that's great. Cheer them. If you wanted to boo somebody, that's wonderful. Boo them. And there is a person today that has that philosophy, and his name is John Cena. John Cena is himself. And John Cena comes out to the ring and he presents himself. He doesn't pretend to be anybody else besides John Cena. Now, there are people who pay to see John Cena so that they can come into the arena and scream, "Let's go, Cena." And they buy his T-shirts and they buy his wristbands and they buy his hats. And they buy more of his merchandise than any other superstar in WWE today or in the past 10 years. There are those who come to the arena to boo John Cena. Cena sucks. And they are passionate and they have great fervor in their conviction that John Cena sucks and I'm going to pay for a ticket to tell that man that he sucks. And the fact is, they're willing to pay for the right and the privilege to do so. That makes John Cena the biggest attraction in the industry today. John Cena is defined as a babyface, but he's booed as much as he's cheered, but he's himself. And people pay to boo him as much as people pay to cheer him, which makes him a star. That was the ECW philosophy. Be a star. They boo you? Great. They cheer you? Great. And here's a classic example of that. I would suggest to you that in the history of ECW, the most popular, when you take all the figures involved, ticket sales, merchandise sales, videotape sales, etc., etc., and just longevity as well, the most popular wrestler, I think, ECW branded wrestler, ended up being Rob Van Dam. There are those who would suggest that the Sandman gets that title, and in some ways, in some numbers, the Sandman does. But in reviewing where we were then, I think Rob Van Dam was the most popular and sold the most tickets in the time that he was on top. When Rob Van Dam would defend the ECW World Television title, I never strictly booked him against heels. We also booked him against babyfaces.
Right.
And Van Dam was so good back then. He's so underrated and underappreciated in how talented he was. That at the beginning of the match, the RVD chants and the Rob Van Dam chants and the whole fucking show chants drowned out everything in the arena. It was just loud and passionate, and the audience was so into him. But when he was working with a babyface, whether it be Spike Dudley or Tommy Dreamer, or even an underneath talent like Mike Lazansky, or Jerry Lynn especially, and that's really the best example of it. When Van Dam worked with another babyface, by the time they got into the false finishes of the match, you were cheering the other guy, hoping to see a title change. And then Van Dam would turn the tide, hit the Van Daminator. The Van Terminator is the coast to coast. He'd hit the Van Daminator, which is the kicking the chair into the face, and of course, the split legged moonsault and the 5-star frog splash. And when it was over, everybody's standing on their feet and they're chanting ECW, which was the philosophy of the company. Get the company over above all other talent so that the company could survive another day if anybody left. But that was also the philosophy in that everybody became a star. Try to find how to make these people stars.
Well, let's look back at that roster you guys had back then, because it was a hell of a roster. And, okay, Rob Van Dam was at the top of it. But then you had Raven, Sandman, Cactus Jack or Mick Foley, whatever you want to call him, Shane Douglas.
The Dudley Boys.
The Dudley Boys. But more in a singles vein, as I'm thinking.
Taz.
Okay, what was it about Rob that those people, those ECW fans, gravitated towards so strongly?
His moves were original.
Yeah.
His look was different. And his promos were so charming and so different than any other. What buried Rob Van Dam when he got into WWE was that his promos were so different that no one in WWE understood the verbiage that he was using and the mechanism by which he was conveying his message to the audience. What made Rob Van Dam in ECW was exactly the same thing. His message was different. He would be, hey, man, I'm Rob Van Dam, and RVD 420 means I just smoked your ass, man. Listen, this is a real puff, puff, pass society, and it's ruled by Rob Van Dam. And people would just say, this guy is so full of himself. He was so entertaining. He was so different. Again, we had very, as you know, very visceral, very violent promos in ECW. When you have New Jack standing there swearing he's going to stab people, and then the Public Enemy talking about growing up in the hood, and Mick Foley with just those brilliant, brilliant, brilliant promos, and your promos, which were very angry and angst-ridden and rebelling against the system that didn't give you the break that you deserved. And even Raven's promos talking about a drunk, abusive father and a mother that didn't step in to save him, and the girlfriend that left him for Tommy dreamer. And then here's Rob Van Dam, and hey man, he's California cool, and you know, and hey, you know, one day I'm gonna roll you up, man, and just saying, well, speaking of rolling up, Fonzie, man, could you walk away and roll me something so that when I'm done, I could take a puff? And this was unheard of, you know, back then.
Right.
And he looked straight in that camera and he gave that Rob Van Dam smile, and people related to him. They loved him.
Let's wrap this up. Always do a bunch of false finishes on his last few podcasts because one thing leads to another. As we did the other day, we talked for an hour and a half. And, you know, I might end up playing that down the road. We'll call it the Lost Heyman episode when I was a zombie. Before we close this thing up, let's talk about Brock Lesnar and John Cena. It's a couple of weeks removed. SummerSlam, Brock Lesnar put a hellacious beatdown on John Cena. F5, 30 seconds into the match, 16 suplexes. Absolutely decimated him. A one-sided victory. Beat the hell out of John Cena. And John Cena is one tough-ass cat. Y'all came out the next Monday to a babyface reaction, somewhat. And there was somewhat of a babyface pop at the end of the match. You came out, turned it around, go into your promo mode, which you've been knocking him out of the park as of late in the last, Jesus Christ, I don't know how long. You've been a great promo since you were born, but you're really coming into the zone where you're at right now, which is just unheard of. And me and Jim Ross were talking about it on an earlier podcast. And then as we speak, Monday Night Raw was in Anaheim, California. John Cena, who wasn't at the Monday Night Raw following the beatdown, the kid had taken too many suplexes, shows up and says, I think he knocked this promo out of the park because I was wondering where he was going to go with this. He didn't make any excuses. He owned up to the ass whooping, and he said, and there was the panel out there, Shawn Michaels, Hulk Hogan, and Ric Flair, and says his mission was not to beat Brock Lesnar. His mission at Night of Champions, Paul, was to beat Brock Lesnar's ass. I loved it. You guys got your work cut out for you. In the SummerSlam match, I didn't think John Cena ever got around to getting to that place which he had spoke of, which wasn't going to make him so much a role model for the kids. He was going to have to dig into a very deep, dark place. The F5 cut him off from that, all the German suplexes. Your thoughts on where you guys are at right now, because I'm loving the way this thing's unfolding.
I'm fascinated by what happens with the John Cena character from here. Because clearly making the statement that he's walking into a title match and it's a rematch that he invoked to beat Brock Lesnar's ass. His mission is not to win the title back. His mission is not to beat Brock Lesnar. His mission is to beat Brock Lesnar's ass. Now that is an intriguing moment in the arc of the John Cena character. And what's obvious as we have three more weeks of television before Night of Champions, to me, is that for John Cena to beat Brock Lesnar's ass, John Cena has to stop being the role model. Hustle, loyalty, and respect will get slaughtered by the beast Brock Lesnar every single time. So John Cena is going to have to find a dark place in his soul to where he's willing to stick both thumbs through Brock Lesnar's eyes. That John Cena is willing to do the things that he wasn't willing to do against Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania. That the pursuit of the championship and regaining the title to be your hero is now secondary to John Cena because he's on a personal mission to exact revenge for the most heinous ass-kicking slash victimization he's ever taken in his life. This gives me so much promo material to work with over the next 3 weeks. It gives the announcers so much to talk about. It gives other superstars something to say. It's a place where John Cena has never been. It's uncharted turf for the top star in the company, and he's the top star for the past decade. I am very interested to see when I push John Cena's buttons next Monday on Raw, where his character takes the rebuttal.
But it's going to be interesting to see, and for me as well, the detour that he takes from being the role model that he is
to go around to being what he needs to be to destroy Brock Lesnar, to go back to being the role model and the person who John Cena at his core is and who the people believe him to be. He's got to make that detour to come back to ground zero.
But you know, once you take that detour, can you ever really go back? Once they see John Cena stick his thumb through someone's eye, once they see John Cena try to break someone's neck, once they see John Cena with bloodlust in his eyes, can he really go back to being the wristband wearing, pump up your sneakers, let me tell a fart joke on television, John Cena? Or are we at the precipice of the evolution of the John Cena character? You know, I mean, how far can it go? I can sell it to you as, if John Cena truly wants to beat Brock Lesnar's ass, John Cena has to start thinking like a Paul Heyman guy. So is that the road John Cena starts to travel down now? I'm not suggesting that's where we're going, but it certainly is a possibility. Once John Cena shows you that bloodlust in his eye, I don't think he goes back to being cartoony John Cena.
I don't think he goes back to being cartoony John Cena. For me, it's I know how passionate he is. Sometimes he goes to the passion well one too many times. What has gotten me, and I'm a big John Cena fan anyway because I'm a top guy. I know what it takes to be a top guy, so I watch everything that he does. But what I like now is the focus and intensity of who and what John Cena is and what he will do to beat Brock Lesnar's ass. Not beat Brock Lesnar, but to beat his ass. Can and will he do that? And what will happen if he can?
It's a fascinating, fascinating time for the character of John Cena and for his audience, because clearly he's going to have to undergo some sort of evolution and transformation. And whether that detour leads him to becoming a far more aggressive character, whether that detour leads him to becoming a Paul Heyman guy, whether that detour leads the character to shift his focus into his matches more so than having the sense of humor and being the ultimate face of the company, is going to be a fascinating journey. This is really, in WWE, this is new turf, because as we talked about earlier with the difference between the New York style of booking as opposed to other styles of booking, the Dusty style of booking, which was very heel oriented. This is the first time that I can recall where the journey of the babyface is as important as the destination. And again, to draw a parallel here, the last time they had such a long journey was the evolution of the Stone Cold character, going all the way finally to where DX and Mike Tyson was conspiring against you, to where you had to overcome all the odds at WrestleMania for your first title win against Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels.
And difference being mine a little bit more attitudinal, him a little bit more, you know, family friendly.
Yes.
But the same parallel.
Yes, it was the journey of the Stone Cold character to where finally you had the soundbite from JR that the Austin era has begun. We've been in the Cena era for 10 years, but this is going to have a new John Cena wrinkle to it. We are about to see a change in the character. So where does that persona go? How can I push that persona into a compromising situation that he has to verbally swing his way out of? How does the beast Brock Lesnar position John Cena into a fight that John Cena has to violate his own code of hustle, loyalty, and respect? You know, when does fighting evil require you to become evil to defeat evil? And that's where John Cena's character has to go. And how he comes out on the other side, to me, is the most fascinating aspect of it.
Because what happens once he gets a taste of that evil? Does he like it? Does he want to stay down that road?
Yeah, see, that's an interesting question that only the storyline playing out can answer.
I think what he needs to do is accomplish the task at hand, and that's beating Brock Lesnar's ass and Those are his words. I'm just rephrasing what he said. But as you know, you're probably one of the closest friends that Brock Lesnar has. I know Brock very well myself. That's much easier said than done.
That's the most interesting question of all. What happens if John Cena can't beat Brock Lesnar's ass? What happens if we walk in the Night of Champions and Brock Lesnar throws an even more severe, dare I say, extreme thrashing into John Cena's face? What if this time, as you said, it's 20 suplexes instead of 16? What if Brock F5s John Cena through the mat? What if John Cena can't accomplish the task and has to accept what is clearly failure? He failed to get any offense on Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. He failed to defend the championship against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. John Cena failed to prevent the Beast from getting his hands on the undisputed WWE World Heavyweight Championship. What happens this time if John Cena fails again? He failed against The Rock in the first WrestleMania match that they had, and he spent a whole year's journey to become champion, to be rematched with The Rock, to then beat The Rock at WrestleMania. What if this time John Cena's quest for comeuppance, for revenge, for equaling out the slate fails? How does John Cena handle back-to-back failure? That's another interesting aspect of this, because John Cena kicking Brock Lesnar's ass is not a guarantee. It's not fait accompli. And until it happens, it hasn't really happened.
But one thing he must do, and we'll wrap it up with this, we're just going to finish up with a little Paul Heyman business. What he must do is go to the place that he said he was going to do at SummerSlam, the darkest, deepest place that he'd have to go to beat Brock Lesnar. So that, to me, is one place that he has to go. Now, whether he succeeds or fails in the match remains to be seen, but he must go to that place. He said he was going to go to SummerSlam, F5, 30 seconds in, didn't happen, never had a chance. He's got to on number two at Night of Champions, and that's the bottom line. I'm going to shut down this recording now. This is Paul Heyman sitting up here on top of the house.
Hey, are we going to talk about WrestleMania 32?
No.
It's in Texas Stadium,
you
know.
The card is getting full.
Oh, no. Is the card? Are we running out of time?
You know what? I did a couple of interviews the other day, and people were talking about WrestleMania 31, I guess, in Santa Clara, wherever it's over. It's right. It's 100 miles from here. And then you got 32 coming up in Texas Stadium. So all of a sudden, it's like, hey, Steve Austin selling a match. Steve Austin selling a match. And I said, I reserve the right to, if I want to wrestle, I'll say, hey, I got my left hand up in the air. I want to wrestle. I ain't selling shit, so we don't even need to start selling shit.
Well, but I'd like you to wrestle.
Yeah, of course.
I think it'd be a great attraction, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, WrestleMania 32, Texas Stadium, you know, one night only, the return of the Rattlesnake.
I don't know if there's a worthy opponent out there, do you?
Oh, I happen to have one in mind. The toughest SOB in WWE history versus the baddest dude on the planet?
And that's where we're going to leave off.
We don't have more time to talk about it?
No.
We can negotiate terms.
No.
I mean, you know, I mean, if there's interest, you know, can I take you out to lunch?
No.
We'll go to that sushi joint.
No, I got to go turn this in to make delivery for tomorrow.
Maybe we can air it on Friday and talk more about it.
I
mean, WrestleMania 32, Stone Cold, Stone Cold!
All right, let's give a shout out to our friends at Geico. Go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at geico.com. Extra money in your pocket, it may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, I'm giving Sean a go-home cue, so let's wrap it up for this week. Make sure you check out podcast1.com and subscribe to The Steve Austin Show so you don't miss any of these classic episodes. Before I ride off in the sunset, I do want to throw out a couple of plugs. I still got a beer. It's the badass Broken Skull IPA, the finest IPA in the United States of America, and that's the bottom line. Made by El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you ain't in Cali, you're probably SOL. And if you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, I got two for you. Cold steel broken skull knife, cold steel working man knife. Get them at my Amazon store.
Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin, or go to the Cold Steel Knives website and check out all their badass knives. Also, one more big shout out to all my sponsors to make this show possible. That's how I'm able to bring this show to you free twice a week. Please support them because they support us. For more info, check out the podcast description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, @SteveAustinBSR. Folks, I'll be back soon, but until then, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.